Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Future of Media Explained, where this week we're talking about why publishers should court Microsoft and Amazon. So you're here with me, Press Gazette UK editor Charlotte Tabit, and Press Gazette editor-in-chief Dominic Ponsford. Hi, Dom.
Hi, Charlotte.
So this week's conversation touches on a lot of the big themes that we've been covering on Press Gazette so far in 2024. Do you just want to quickly summarise for us what those are?
Well, this one touches on the overall problem, which is how we fund quality content in the digital age. And we focus in a bit more closely on advertising, so what I'm calling the addressability crisis. The publishers are losing online ad revenue because they're not able to direct advertising at them. And also challenges to do with generative AI, whether that's a threat or an opportunity. And I've spoken to a chap called Ricky Sutton, who's really well placed to have a view on this, because he used to be a very senior online executive at News UK and Fairfax Media in Australia. For the last few years, he's been running his own tech company, which is around online video for publishers. And just in the last sort of 6 months or so, he's launched his own Substack called Future Media, which is a bit like ours. He's a sort of kindred spirit because he's quite salty in his criticism of big tech and Google in particular. And he's got some very forthright views about what publishers can do when it comes to how they survive in a media market which is completely dominated now by Google and Facebook.
Well, you literally did compare Google to the Empire in Star Wars in our latest newsletter, so you also can have some spicy takes.
Yeah, sorry about that, Google. I think I got I got a bit carried away, and I feel a bit guilty there, because you know, when you speak to people at Google personally, they're very nice. They're not stormtroopers by any means. I think the thing about online advertising, it gets quite dry, doesn't it, when you talk about cookies and addressability and stuff. So, but there's no getting away from the fact that when it comes to that market, that online advertising market, you know, publishers used to dominate it. Now Google and Facebook dominate it, and you know, the result has been, you know, thousands and thousands of journalists losing their jobs because there's a lot less revenue in the industry because it's elsewhere.
Completely, and it's something that lots of people are wrestling with at the moment. So let's hear from Ricky and your conversation.
So I started off by just a bit of background about Ricky.
I've now worked on both sides. I've worked at the top of media, news media. I've worked at the top of technology, and I've built a company, funded it, and exited it, an AI company. So now, for me, I want to take all of that experience and offer it to companies to try and build what I think can be an incredibly valuable and sustainable future for technology companies, big tech and big media to work together.
Okay, well, that's good to hear that you're sort of optimistic there, because I read your Future Media Substack, which it's, yeah, you don't pull any punches. I can tell you, you know, former tabloid journalist, you're you know, giving it to sort of Google both barrels in a sense that you're really concerned, aren't you, and bothered about the dominance of the tech companies versus publishers and what that all means. When did you first start getting really riled about what was going on with big tech as regards the business we love, which is journalism, quality content?
Yeah, I think the alarm for me started, as crazy as it sounds, in late 1999. So I was heading up digital at News Corp in London at the time, and Google came to see us. We were aware of Google. They were the rising search engine. It was clear that they mattered, but they were still a very small company, and they wanted our permission to allow them to reference our content. And there was a meeting held, and we all discussed it, and we all agreed that that would be okay. Let's do that. Let's see how they go. And what was kind of agreed behind closed doors was that if this Google thing gets big, then we'll buy it, because that's what you do when you're News Corp. And so my first real signal of big tech and its potential power was way back then. But what actually transpired, of course, was that digital grew incredibly quickly through the dot-com boom through the late 90s, early 2000s, 2001. But then by the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, we were heading into the dot-com crash. And at this point, the view was that we needed to pull back on our digital ambitions, and perhaps digital wasn't going to be a big deal after all. Maybe this was all just kind of a flash in the pan, certainly a view that was being spread by many people in News Corp, senior people in News Corp at the time. But my worry was that didn't seem to be impacting at all on Google. Google was going to Mars as far as I could see. When I was looking at every chart, it showed that Google was going up and to the right very, very quickly. And when we went back to News Corp to push them to buy this company, which was now probably valued, I think, from recollection, at a couple of $1 billion, the answer was an absolute haughty no. That's absolutely not going to happen. Dot-com's a disaster. And of course, by the time the dot-com rebounded, Google was out of sight for a company the size of News Corp. So for me, it seems ridiculous that I probably worried about the power of big tech in 99. But the truth was, I got a first view of just how fast it gets away from you at that point. It was like a wildfire. And so I've been really worried about it ever since.
Well, what an interesting sort of alternative reality there, where Rupert Murdoch might have bought Google for a couple of billion. And mind you, they probably never would have sold it, would they? Because they had a bit of belief, didn't they, in where it was all going. But it's an interesting thought experiment, isn't it? Where we'd be now if I think there's no way regulators would have allowed Rupert to have had such a big monopoly. But I'm sure they would have broken it up long ago if he was running it, as opposed to the tech bros who used to have the slogan, didn't they? Don't be evil. But I think they sort of quietly stop that at some point and just start becoming evil. I don't know.
They did. They did. But look, you know, to be honest with you, there was a different balance back then, clearly, an ability to be able to have some kind of control over our future. But as soon as you lost control of distribution, which was effectively the risk that Google represented, and they just disappeared out of sight so quickly. And so by the time digital was back in real full force in kind of the early, late 2003, 2004, it was just a different shape. And of course, in 2004, Google had escaped already, but in 2004, Facebook launched. So, you know, it was kind of, you rolled from one crisis almost directly into another one. So it all happened incredibly quickly.
Let's set out the problem, shall we? So when I kind of do my sort of back of a fag packet calculation, you know, I reckon maybe Google and Facebook worth 15 billion in revenue, ad revenue in the UK, versus every publisher combined maybe worth 2 billion. For all I know, Google and Facebook could be a lot more than that, actually, but that's a sort of conservative estimate. So I think they've got something like 40% of the whole ad market. If you look back to when I started out in this game about 20 years ago, that's about the proportion that the publishers had. So they've sort of exactly replaced publishers in the ad market, in what is a much bigger ad market today than it was back then. So they're sort of utterly dominant. Publishers continuing to shrink. It seems to be getting worse, not better, because the Googler are switching off cookies and so taking control of those identifiers. And so, you know, is that what you're seeing globally, and how sort of serious is the issue for publishers as regards ad-funded journalism?
Right, okay. So it absolutely is what I'm seeing, and it absolutely is terrible, right? However, where I am seeing some optimism is that it's a choice to work with Google, right? It's not a requirement, it's a choice. And so at the moment, you're quite right, Google controls the vast majority of everything, right? The number of ads that are being supplied, the programmatic platform, the pipes, the data, the delivery, the measurement, like all of it, owns the entire thing. And so Google has reached a point of total dominance. However, its point of dominance is so comprehensive that it's now scared American politicians. And that's a great thing, because the only thing that can stop a monopoly when it gets to that size is effectively antitrust, an action where the government decides to break that company up because it's now antithetical to competition in the market. And so I think Google had a chance a couple of years ago to stop relentlessly growing and create a sustainable dominant business, but it couldn't resist the temptation or fell victim to shareholder pressure to just continue to gouge the market to the point where it became too much for the government to be willing.
And just Google aren't here, so I mean, just to sort of give their point of view, I suppose they would see themselves as in a bit of a, although dominant to us, I suppose they're in a battle with Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon in a sort of similar-ish market, and I suppose they probably see their position and their rivalry between those other companies as a sort of fairly sort of fragile position in a way, because they, you know, they could easily, I suppose, in their mind, be supplanted by one of those other giants that have got a similarly sort of monopolistic control over content and platforms in their own way.
That's you're being very fair to them. Look, I think that the you know, it's not for me actually to judge whether they are an illegal monopoly or not, because a judge is going to decide that soon enough anyway. So there's a search antitrust case already underway in the US that's going to rule sometime later this year. And then today, just this morning, we've heard that there's an antitrust case against Google's advertising, or targeting Google's advertising monopoly, kicking off in September. And they've already lost their antitrust case over the App Store. So it will be for judges to decide and what action that they want to take. You're absolutely right, though. Google has argued that, you know, its competitor is definitely in competition with Amazon. It talks about that. It says it's in competition with Yelp. It says it's in competition with everybody that's got a search engine. But it does have 90% share of, you know, that was what was the number given in court. It has 90% share of global search volume. So whether it's a monopoly or not, whether that's an emotive word or not, it still has 90% of the market.
Yeah. And taking my defending Google hat off again, I think, you know, I look at my phone, you know, I've got an Android phone like most people nowadays. The first thing I see on my phone when I open it up is Google Discover. So Google Discover, which I assume Google has paid Samsung a shit ton of money to be there on my phone. So it's got, it kind of controls that position. And the phone is the thing which most people, everyone spends most of their time looking at. It's how we consume media. And every fifth article I scroll at on Discover on my phone is an advert, which is Google's paid a lot of money to be there. And so Google kind of owns the newsstand now, doesn't it?
$3 billion they paid for that Samsung deal came out in the court case.
$3 billion. And so we can only imagine how much money they're making in return. So they paid $3 billion. You know, they're probably, I don't know, maybe they're making $10 billion globally. Who knows? But it's a lot of cash. And it's I suppose, it raises, it feels like a sort of one of a number of areas where there's a clear case for saying that's a monopoly, that needs to be regulated. Apart from anything else, the algorithm is far less discriminating on Discover than it is even on Google News. Like, Google News is legit news providers. Discover, there's some legit stuff on there. There's an awful lot of utter crap, fake news nonsense. And, you know, and that's probably how a lot of people understand the world at the moment.
Well, remember that, you know, it's not just, you don't just find that on Samsung phones, right? So you've got the same issue with all Android phones. And you've also got the challenge that, you know, Google's paying billions and billions of dollars, like three times as much as they're paying Samsung to Apple to be the default search engine on Apple. So if you're using an Apple mobile or an Android mobile, you're getting Google, and that's pretty much all mobile. So, you know, if you've got 90% of the web searches and you've got, you know, that many of the mobile searches, you're incredibly dominant. But just to go back to your point earlier on about, you know, what is the real harm that this represents? Because I think as much as I'm railing against their dominance and trying to find, to carve out a niche or an opportunity or a window or a way to sustain news publishing, because that's what I care about, their search engine is bloody fantastic. It does amazing things. It's made the world far more discoverable. I'm a smarter person for it, and so are my children. And so from that perspective, you have to admire them for the work that they've done.
I'd be annoyed if I was suddenly forced to use Bing or Ask Jeeves. I think I would choose Google, definitely, given the choice.
Right. But the problem is that when you become that powerful and you live in that bubble, and the question for your next earnings report is whether you're going to be up by 24 billion or 25 billion is the question you're asking yourself in that quarter, right? The problem is it's very difficult to maintain perspective on the impact that you're having on the world in general. And so we've kind of reached a point where they've become so massive, there's no more market share really for them to take. There's no more customers really that they can go to. And so the question then becomes, how do you continue to maintain double-digit growth? And that's when things get a bit tricky, because then you have to start to impact on user experience. You have to take the money from the people that don't have much money left. And the problem is that for Google, and given how much content publishers generate that people want to read every day on the web, it basically puts the publishing industry right in the headlights of the Google juggernaut. And so that's why antitrust, in my view, has to happen, because it gives us an opportunity to reset and carve out enough space for the publishing industry to sustain itself. I mean, we need probably $4 billion, probably, to reoxygenate the industry. And that's nothing for these big tech companies. And I think that finally politicians and regulators and everybody have figured out that that's actually a trade worth doing, because we need a vibrant plurality of media outlets.
So I guess the one of the big challenges with all this historically has been, how do you come up with a way of rewarding sort of good content, you know, good quality content, quality journalism in the online space, and encouraging what we would see as good things? So, I mean, I think, you know, that's original journalism, I would say, which holds power to account, serves public interest in some way, but without also rewarding bad things. So churnalism, so just copycat stuff. And I don't want to be sort of snooty, but there's a lot of kind of celebrity journalism, which is sort of guff. It's just shit happening on TikTok. Let's write about it, as opposed to, you know, good celebrity journalism, which probes a bit and tells you something you didn't know. It's very, very hard to sort of find some, you know, new way of running the world, which kind of, you know, promotes the good stuff and not just the rubbish.
I'll give you two thoughts, two models. One of them's mine, but the other one's Google's. So I went after Google on stage in 2019. And had quite a robust discussion in a panel that really got on their radar. And they rang me and said, look, we want to find a way to be sustainable. What do you think we should do, right? And I said to them, I think you should take $1 billion out of YouTube's income from all the junk and you should take that $1 billion, you should put it into a special purpose advertising unit that should only be available to premium publishers. And if you want to know who the premium publishers are, sign up every publisher that's a member of one of the major industry groups. So if they're a member of WANIFRA, a member of INMA, a member of the ONA, if it's one of them, then make that $1 billion available to them. And when they publish their stories, have those, that $1 billion only be available there, and make the minimum CPM on display $20, right? If you do that, you'll put $1 billion back into the publishing industry. Their response to that was, we love that idea, but we don't think $1 billion is enough. How much do you think we'd need to put in to fund it all? And that led to a big dinner in London where we discussed it. It then led to an offer on a piece of paper, but the offer didn't have a sum of money in it. It just said best endeavors. And so ultimately that deal died, but it's the right deal to do if you're Google. So Google should segment a pool of cash of advertising inventory from the vast amount that it's got and make it available just to those publishers. That's a model that could work.
I suppose in UK terms, you could include regulated publishers in that pot.
Yeah, but there's no downside for Google to do that, okay? Serving higher yielding CPMs, there are plenty of advertisers that would be happy to pay higher yielding CPMs. And in Google's perspective, it gets paid for selling the ad, it gets paid for delivering the ad, it gets paid for measuring the ad. There's no downside. That's one way that they could be a better corporate citizen. But the other way of doing it is to go back to what we discussed back in that room at News Corp back in 1999, which was to say to Google, look, rather than just take our content and use it, you should license it from us. So each time our content is queried, or our content is the response to someone's search query, then you should pay us a micro fee for that. So instead of having the variability of do I have an ad, don't I have an ad, is it high yielding, is it low yielding, do I have high sell through or low sell through, or I don't want to put an ad on news content because it might not be the right place for my holiday ad to go. All of those variables are antithetical to us in news industry being able to do what we do best, which is tell the news. So a better model is for Google to just pay on a response to every search query. So if somebody goes and searches for blue whale and it finds a story from the Sun from 2 years ago, and that's the story, then the Sun should be paid a micro fee for that. And if somebody searches for, you know, the latest on, today's story on the King, then they should also get a micro fee for that. And then what happens is that the people, the journalists that are writing the best stories about the things that people care most about will ultimately get paid the most because they'll get the most responses in the query. It just kills SEO, which is a way to go and try and con the system to make sure you're at the top, which leads to bad journalism. But what it does is it leads you to good journalism, because if it's what people want to read, it's what people then discover. And so being paid on a per discovery basis, on a pay-as-you-go model, is far more sustainable. You just do what you do every day, but instead of being paid in advertising, you're paid in a micro fee whenever your search query is found. So if 100,000 times your story is discovered by Google in an hour, you get paid 100,000 micro payments. You get paid for when your content is found. You don't write it to be found. You get paid when it is found.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and I host the New Statesman podcast. Twice a week, we get under the skin of Westminster to help understand what's going on and what's going to happen next. We interview politicians, policymakers, and people on the front line to get you the full story behind the headlines. Plus, hear from our award-winning editorial team, including political editor Andrew Marr, to get to the bottom of what on earth is happening. Listen to the New Statesman podcast. You can subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
What do you think about this the Google's argument, which it makes, and which Facebook has also made, probably more convincingly, that journalism is negligible in terms of their revenue. I think they say they don't make any money from Google News, and that more than 90% of queries are nothing to do with news. So you get rid of all the journalism on Google. It's not going to bother them too much. And in fact, they do the news industry, an incredible service, because they send billions of clicks to the news industry every year. So what would you say to that?
Well, a couple of things. So, of course, the web's full of junk. And so if you go and search for, how much is a 1886 silver spoon worth, right? You're not expecting to find a response from the Times of London, right? So no one's expecting that to happen. I think it's a silly response from a smart company designed to obfuscate the truth. The truth is that every day a massive number of searches will be about the things that are happening in the world today. So, with the King's cancer diagnosis in the UK, do you think anybody searched for that today? And what did they find? Right. So I just think it's a self-serving obfuscation. It makes no sense. It's just not true. And so challenge them to show it's true. Challenge them to show you the numbers. They never will. Challenge them to ask what ads are going to go where and where they're going to get the most money from the ads from. Do you think they make more money for an ad that sits on the Times than on an ad that sits on some bot generated, article about something that somebody's peripherally interested in? They're totally different. So I think I understand why they're saying it, but it's not true. And even if what they're saying is partially true from viewed from their objective, then they should just make the numbers visible, not hide them, which they do. Go and have a look at what the top 20 searches were on Google last year. They're all news articles, right? So it just can't be right.
So you said part of your role now is advising publishers. So I guess a lot of this stuff is, theoretical, and a lot of it is, from a publisher point of view, it's sort of complaining about the weather, isn't it? It's not something you can really directly control. So what would your advice be to publishers who are looking at that, those figures? They're looking at the online revenue going down. They're having to fire journalists as a result. Any thoughts about, what they should be doing this year to try and flatten out that revenue curve and hopefully grow it a little bit and hopefully maybe hire a few journalists and not have to fire so many?
Yeah, I got hundreds of ideas on that, Dom. But look, I'll give you what I think the most important and pertinent ones are. So the first thing is that the advertising market's not going down, it's going up. It always has been. So it's a myth in publishers that we believe the ad market's going backwards. It isn't. It's been growing pretty much consistently except during COVID. It's just that the money's bypassing publishers and going directly to the platforms. So that's the first thing to recognize. That means that probably advertising is a really challenging space for publishers to remain in as this year extends. I don't only advise publishers, I also advise big tech companies, right? So the big tech companies are also trying to find a way to exist and continue to grow and thrive themselves in this new era that we're entering into in generative AI. So if you look at the most valuable companies that sit in that list, you've got Microsoft is now at the top, followed by Apple, followed by Amazon, followed by Alphabet, okay? And then there's a gap, and then you get to Meta. Now, those are the ones that really impact on us as an industry. And so the question you need to ask yourself is, what do they want? Right? What enables them to be more dominant? Now, every single one of them has a problem and a need, especially now in this AI era. So let's start at the top. If you're Microsoft, you're in the lead on AI. And most estimates say that the AI market is going to be worth probably another $1.5 trillion in value. Okay. And that $1.5 trillion has to come from market growth, which will probably be about 30% of it. But the rest of it has to come from taking it from other companies, which means that Microsoft needs to take another $1 trillion from one of those other companies I've just mentioned. And the one that's in the most trouble at the moment is Google. So Google's already lost $1 trillion in its gap between it and Microsoft. Microsoft soared into the distance. But it's also looking pretty vulnerable. Google. It's not doing terribly well with AI. It keeps getting punished by its investors. Losing ground on cloud that it keeps getting punished for. And Microsoft is picking all this up. So if you play that game and you try and work out who in that, who in the zoo is going to be the best partner for publishers, it's going to be the one with the most momentum and the one with the biggest need. And right now, Microsoft has everything to gain and Google has everything to lose. So there's an auction opportunity here. So my answer to you in what publishers should do this year is to break their thought about being reliant on advertising, because that puts them in the hands of Google and Google's the one that's losing. And think about what is going to enable them to succeed with the companies that are going to grow. So here's two important stats to recognize. First thing, Microsoft owns AI and it wants another $1.5 trillion and it will spend money. Okay, so it's just done its first deal today. Microsoft Direct has done its first deal today with Semaphore in the US, where it's paid Semaphore for access to their content. Previously, OpenAI did a deal with Axel Springer, okay, in Germany and in America, but that was a much, much smaller deal. This is a much bigger deal. So that's the first thing to think about. The other number to think about is 27%, which is how much Amazon grew its advertising unit last year. So Amazon's ad unit is already headed to $100 billion this year, and it's all growing faster than Meta and Google, right? It's got a faster growth than both of them. Amazon, like Microsoft, has everything to gain, okay, by spending money now to grow market share. So I think what we're actually seeing is the era of Meta being a friend of publishers ended a couple of years ago. The era of Google being a friend of publishers is ending right now. And the new friends are the two that need publishing most, and they are Microsoft and Amazon.
So you're saying you think opportunities for publishers to license content to AI via Microsoft?
I do.
And then via Amazon, maybe... Doing deals. I mean, Reach have just done a deal, haven't they?
They have. Reach did a deal yesterday.
So it's independent of cookies. So it's independent of anything Google does. Reach collects behavior data about what its readers are reading, sharing that data with Amazon Publisher Services. And then Amazon is then using that data and using Reach's sort of massive amount of inventory to then sell advertising inventory to its buyers, its ad buyers. We don't know the nuts and bolts of it, but we have to hope that it's a good increase on what Reach. I'm sure it's a big increase on what Reach we're getting via Google on the open market, and so it's potentially a good opportunity.
So I think they're the first. They're the first canary in the mine. I actually got a phone call today telling me that half a dozen Australian publishers are all about to announce deals as well. So I think in the background, Amazon's been out around the traps. They can smell blood in the water here too. This is an opportunity for them to take market share. There's a reason why Amazon really needs to grow its ad business, is because the online shopping business is very expensive. So it has a very, very high cost of selling things online. But the two businesses that Amazon has that are highest yielding, that make the most money for their shareholders, which is what they're in the business of, are advertising and cloud. And they've already extracted about as much market share as they can get from cloud. So their next growth engine is going to be ads, and it's going to be biting away at Google.
But isn't the history of all this that of publishers kind of getting cozy with the tech companies, things going well for a bit, and then the kind of publishers getting screwed over, for want of a better term? If you look at, certainly if you look at Facebook, I mean, I can remember Facebook being very friendly with publishers. We get going to really nice dinners with them. They had a head of journalism, and they were very much, there were hundreds of jobs dedicated to creating content on Facebook, which they switched off sort of overnight last year, and hundreds of people were sacked. So, isn't this cycle going to repeat itself with Amazon and Microsoft, or is that just something we need to kind of accept and ride it while it's good, and then look for the next thing?
No, I've got a slightly more optimistic view on that, Dom. I think the first thing is that there are a lot of smart people in our industry still, And if we make the same mistake again, then that's our fault. So we got 25 years of scar tissue here, right? And I don't know about you, but it fucking hurts, right? So I know that we know enough here to be able to make better decisions, right? And there are enough of us around that have a lot of experience of this stuff that can help and advise. And I think that, you know, this is an opportunity for us to reset. So the first thing is, look, we have to find a way to coexist in a sustainable manner with these people because they have all the money. So we're going to have to work with them eventually at some point, right? So this AI is an opportunity to reset. It's an opportunity for us to set down what we need. They now need us as well. It's the perfect environment for a sustainable model that works for both parties. The way that we as the publishing industry benefit from this is that we need to not be subservient to them. They need stuff that we do that they can. So what we need to do is we need to make sure that we align what we do with what they need and what we need from what they have, which is basically money. And we need to find a way that our businesses grow in line with their businesses, which is entirely achievable in this window. But to your point, Dom, the reason that Facebook fell out with publishing is that it didn't need publishing anymore. It had taken all the money and all the traffic it needed. It didn't need publishing anymore. So that window for them was over. Their interest in us was over. They wanted to go and fight with, you know, TikTok and get into shorts. Fine. But that means that there's a window for publishing to do the right deal right now. And if Microsoft and Amazon are both interested in doing deals in licensing and in advertising, then those deals need to be done fairly quickly. But they need to be done with a view that any deal that we do grows over time. It doesn't just extinguish or end. And so smart people need to be in the room on those deals, good lawyers.
And as regards Gen AI, obviously the big concern is that, you know, I know you've looked at Google SGE, Search Generative Experience, and we can see, looking at that in the beta testing, it's a kind of, it offers a sort of dystopian future where you ask the computer, you know, what's going on in the world today, and the computer summarizes what's going on in the world today, having read the news, so that sort of you don't need to. So publishers are cut out of the value chain completely. But you can see a future where generative AI is regulated in such a way that publishers are what, rewarded for their input into that, and maybe are also cited and get the sort of the traffic as well. Is that right?
Well, let's ask the question in a slightly different way, and then I'll respond. Do you think Google's going to do it anyway? Right? They're going to do it, right? So it's not like us being unhappy about it is going to stop it. Now, if the New York Times wins its copyright case in the States, that could put the brakes on it, right? But Google hasn't got a history of stopping doing things that work for it. It just does it. So I think we have to plan for what happens, assuming that they do. So you then say, all right, well, is Google search really going to be where everybody finds stuff in the future? So the interesting thing about Bing, you mentioned earlier on, you'd never use it. Bing's picked up 3 points of market share in search in the last quarter. So it's up to 6%. Still a tiny number against Google's 90, but they'd be 87 now. But, you know, they've taken 3 points away in a quarter. That's significant. It's taken them like 10 years to get to 3, right? And it's taken them 3 months to get to 6. So maybe the future of discovering content on the web isn't going to be search like we think it used to be. So if we as an industry can find a way to build a collaborative relationship that's sustainable with a company like Microsoft or with Amazon, then maybe in the future when content is discovered through search, whatever search becomes, maybe it's a spoken query, maybe it's a prompt, maybe it's a co-pilot tool that sits in the top of your Excel document. But however our content is found in that new future, okay, we should be paid for that. And the Google model is an approach to not pay us for that. So therefore, surely the best thing for us to do is to support the ones that are willing to pay for that. And that's the new rivals, the people taking share in search.
Well, look, thanks for all that, Ricky. So, I mean, go back to, for you, to where it all began. 30-some years ago, Bath Chronicle, 10,000 copies a day, newsroom of 50. Today, it's a weekly title run by Reach. Latest circulation figure, just under 3,000 copies a week. So I would imagine, and hopefully someone will correct me if I'm wrong, there's probably two or three journalists now covering that city, you know, if we're lucky. So that watchdog role has been sort of denuded almost to the point of invisibility in large bits of the UK. And that's, you know, that is as a direct result of that ad revenue, which used to support all that journalism, all those thousands of journalists, is now in the hands of, you know, Google, Facebook, and probably to a growing extent, Amazon and Microsoft. So, I mean, do you have any sort of, and I suppose I'm hoping you're going to be optimistic here, but do you have any sort of sense of optimism that in this sort of reset that's going on now, or this recalibration of things, we might end up with a world where there's a bit more sort of journalism going on, a bit more watchdog journalism, hopefully, where reporting is again a bit more profitable?
I absolutely do. And I find myself a lone voice on this a lot of the time. There is enough money out there to sustain our industry and for our industry to be 3, 4, 5 times as big as it is. Our mistake has been to build our products to fit the shapes that tech companies have told us they have to be. We've been subservient to them. AI changes that. The AIs need us now as much as we need them. So the balance of power has shifted. Okay. The challenge for us as a media industry, and I know you talk to the media industry, and we were, you know, I've been a reader and a fan of Press Gazette my entire career, right? I found every job in Press Gazette. So I have great passion for what you do, right? But the problem that I've got is that the management of the industry has got so used to losing, I think we're addicted to it. And I will go and show publishers how to have the ability to win, and I'll open the door for them to go and do a deal, but they're too afraid to do it. So we have to remember who we are and what we mean. We need to dust ourselves off, get off the floor, point ourselves north and go for it. We need to regain our confidence. And the opportunity is right now. And those of us that have the momentum, those of us that have the belief, those of us that have the experience and have the confidence, okay, can stare down and do a deal. But if you genuinely think that you've already lost, okay, then you won't. But that's your fault. It's not the industry's fault. It's not the market's fault. It's not big tech's fault. It's your fault. So you have to find in yourself that strength to go and get that deal done, because it's there right in front of you, right? I was with a publisher in the States. I went to see them. Their office had gone from 250 journos to 6 or 7. I did the meeting with the editor. The editor looked so utterly defeated. At the end of it, I just said to him, are you just done? Have you just had enough? Do you just want to give up? And he kind of sighed and shuffled. And when I left, as I was going my taxi back to my hotel in New York, his publisher rang me and said, did I want to buy the paper for $1? Because I was the only person that had shown an interest in it for a decade. That can't happen. You can't win from that position. You have to believe, okay? And our industry has to survive for all the reasons you've just described, Don, right? I haven't given up, right? There are enough of us around that haven't given up, right? Let's find a way to win. Let's just stop expecting to lose.
Love it. I believe, Ricky. I believe. So, look, thanks for that. Thanks for coming on the podcast. If people want a bit more of Ricky Sutton, your Future Media Substack, it's well worth a read. It's paid for, isn't it? But you also give a certain amount away for free.
It's, but most of the posts are free, but they go behind the paywall after a fortnight. And so quite a lot of what I'm writing about is predicting trends. Quite a lot of those, you know, then tend to happen. So it's a freemium model. You can certainly come in and get a sense and get the learnings from subscribing for the free service.
And how's that working out? A bit of beer money or a bit more than beer money from it?
I'm trying to buy a car. That's my ambition. I'm trying to buy a car with it by the end of the year. So it will be in car buying territory by Q3 this year.
All right. Like a new car or a second-hand car?
A late 60s, early 70s VW Combi is what I'm intending to buy.
Oh, okay. I reckon that's going to set you back a few quid.
It's going to wipe out my subscription revenue, but that's okay. Newsletters have been really enlightening, really interesting model.
Listen, we could talk about that a lot, but let's leave it there. Thanks very much for coming on, Ricky. Good to talk to you.
Cheers, Dan. My pleasure, man. Take it easy.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Dom, and thank you, Ricky, for talking to us. So it was really nice to hear some optimism at the end there, at a time where, you know, at least 8,000 journalism jobs were lost last year in UK, US, Canada, and we're kind of up to probably around 1,000 already this year, mostly in the US. So, Dom, how did you feel after that conversation?
Well, you know, Charlotte, as always, Press Gazette, we're always fired up about news and publishing, aren't we? He makes a good point, which I've heard others say, and others of a similar vintage to him, say that this sort of the news industry has sort of got so used to losing that it's forgotten how to win. And I think maybe that's true. And maybe a bit of a mindset change is what's needed, because at the end of the day, all these platforms are quite dull places to be without professional content. And the internet itself would be a really mad, less interesting place to spend time without, you know, verified journalistic content. And I think, in the age of AI, in the age of technology, it's so easy to like replicate almost anything. But, you know, it's really hard to replicate sort of genuine human journalism, is it? And it's really hard to replicate that sort of endeavor. So I think he's right in the sense that what we all do is incredibly valuable. We need to just try not to forget the value of that, but try and assert it a bit more strongly, especially when publishers are negotiating with these tech platforms.
Love it. Yes, we are winners. We will do this. That should be the mantra.
Exactly. As I said on Twitter about Press Gazette recently, we're simply the best.
Thank you so much again, Dom, Editor-in-Chief, from me, UK Editor Charlotte Tobit, and thank you to Ricky Sutton, our guest for this week. We've been produced by Suze Cooper. Please like, subscribe, review, keep people in our industry finding our podcast, and of course go to pressgazette.co.uk for lots more on this theme. See you in a couple of weeks.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.